I'm Judith Smelser, in for Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. This week on Intersection, the death of Osama bin Laden. Where does it leave the global war on terrorism? We'll hear from a Rollins College expert on this evolving story. Also, jury selection begins next week in the Casey Anthony murder trial, but nobody knows where the jurors are coming from. We'll talk about the costs of sequestering them as the event shapes up to be one of the most expensive trials in Florida history. Plus, the 12th annual Magnolia Park Bluegrass Festival is this Saturday in Apopka, and we'll hear some tunes from one of the bands on the lineup, the all-female Polk County group Ramblin' Rose. All that's ahead this week on Intersection. We go now to the situation in the Middle East in the wake of the news of Osama bin Laden's death in a U.S. military operation. I'm joined now on the phone by Rachel Newcomb. She's an associate professor of anthropology at Rollins College in Orlando, and she's an expert in Middle Eastern affairs. She's done research across the Middle East and North Africa. Rachel, welcome to Intersection. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, tell me in general, where do you think bin Laden's death leaves America's war on terrorism and the fight against Al-Qaeda?
Well, I think it's a huge symbolic victory for the United States, and it provides a lot of closure for the families of the victims of September 11th. But I don't think that the war on terror is necessarily over. I think that even though there are no leaders waiting in the wings who have the power and stature of bin Laden, I do believe that there will still be attacks inspired by Al-Qaeda and splinter groups of Al-Qaeda throughout the region. So I think that's still going to be a problem. I just don't think that anybody of bin Laden's stature is waiting in the wings.
I understand that bin Laden himself was not really actively involved in the day-to-day operations of Al-Qaeda. Is that right? I mean, there were other people sort of running the show?
Right, that's true, but he was a hugely inspirational figure for many people who were in that organization, and whenever they issued his statements, they were watched and observed by a number of people who were who worked for Al-Qaeda in different parts of the world. And so even if he didn't necessarily handle all the operational details of the day-to-day running of the organization, I think his presence as a figurehead was very important.
So if you say that no one is waiting in the wings to take over from him, what does that mean to the operation of Al-Qaeda from here on out? I mean, do they lose membership if they don't have this symbolic figurehead?
Well, I think that they have lost membership already, probably due to events in the region, the Middle East and North Africa, over the past couple of months. The revolutions that have been generated in those regions have not come from Al-Qaeda, and I think in some areas they really show that Al-Qaeda is not relevant to people's everyday lives, that they're going on with other ideas about how they'd like to run their countries and have democracies without needing Al-Qaeda as inspiration.
You of course, have spent time doing research in the Middle East and North Africa. Have you spoken to anyone in the region about bin Laden's death?
I haven't actually talked to anybody yet, but I've been following all my Twitter feeds, and I keep up with a number of bloggers in the Middle East and North Africa. And so I do know that even though the vast majority of people are glad that he's gone, there also have been a significant minority who believe that the U.S. shouldn't have done this. And so there are also people who are scared that there are going to be reprisal attacks against Americans throughout the world.
That's certainly the next concern, isn't it, that that this could have, maybe in the long term, it could be kind of a good effect, but in the short term, could there be reprisals, new terrorist attacks because of his death?
There could be. I don't think that we would see any spectacularly planned September 11th style attacks anywhere at the moment, because I think it will take a while for people to regroup. But I do think that we might see smaller individualized attacks in different parts of the world on possibly on soft targets. So people who are not, you know, they don't have the protection of a heavily guarded embassy or things of that nature.
Would these be people that were largely acting, I guess, somewhat independently? You said there wouldn't be anything huge, big planned events, but somebody acting independently could do something like this?
That's what I think. I think a huge planned event, that there might be word of it in the international security apparatuses, and so something like that probably wouldn't happen. But I'm thinking more of splinter groups or groups that are loosely inspired by Al-Qaeda, but not necessarily taking their commands from anyone within the organization.
Do you think that something on a larger scale could be inspired by this in the long term, the more distant future?
Well, that remains difficult to say. I don't really think that the war on terror is over because I think some of the grievances that people inspired by bin Laden have are still remaining. And some of those grievances, such as the U.S. presence in Saudi Arabia and in Iraq and Afghanistan, that those haven't gone away yet. And so I think people, there are still people with grievances against the U.S., but I also am hopeful that the other events in the region, such as people beginning to take more control of their countries and having a say in the kinds of governments that they want to have there, I'm hopeful that that is going to pull away some of the possible recruitment tools that Al-Qaeda might have used.
One of the things that I've heard about bin Laden himself is that he has personal connections with people who, with deep pockets, people who have been helpful in fundraising for Al-Qaeda. Does his death hurt the fundraising capabilities of the terrorist group?
It may. I don't think that his second-in-command, Ayman al-Zawahiri, enjoys anywhere near the same kind of a support that he has, especially with Arabs from the Gulf states. And so I do wonder whether the ability to finance such large operations is going to still be present. I'm sure there will still be people who would donate, but he was definitely considered a charismatic leader. And the fact that he's not around anymore, I'm not sure anybody like him exists just yet.
Rachel Newcomb, you mentioned the situation that's going on now in the Middle East and North Africa with the revolutions, the uprisings in Egypt and Tunisia, the ongoing battle in Libya. How do you think that the death of bin Laden will affect the way these things are playing out?
I feel like they're not going to change things all that much. I think that the thing that's been so exciting about these uprisings is that they have been generated by groups of people within these countries, and they have not been inspired by Salafi religious ideologies for the most part. They have been pro-democracy movements, people who've joined up on Facebook, and I think things are going to continue business as usual. You know, we don't really know what's going to be the outcome of these demonstrations in places like Syria or Libya, where things have turned into outright revolt and war. But, you know, they're going to continue, and they don't really have much to do with bin Laden.
You know, another interesting aspect of this is that it seems to have some implications between U.S.-Pakistani relations. Bin Laden, of course, was killed by American forces in a large, highly secured compound in Pakistan, very near the grounds of a military academy. The city where he was killed is home to numerous Pakistani forces, and bin Laden was apparently living there for several years. I mean, could he have survived there for so long without at least the tacit approval of Pakistan's government or military or both?
Right. I think this is an open question, and the fact that the president mentioned that he spoke with the leader of Pakistan, it sounded like after the event had taken place, makes me wonder whether they knew that it was going to take place, or that they were they just weak in their intelligence, or were they willfully not letting the United States know that bin Laden was there?
Pakistan, of course, at least publicly, saying that it's a partner of the U.S. in the war against terrorism, the U.S. saying the same thing. Do you think that there was something going on behind the scenes that really suggests that wasn't the case?
Right. It's possible. It's difficult to understand how someone could have be living there in plain sight for so many years without the Pakistani government knowing about it. And we're not really sure about what intelligence was shared between Pakistan and America. But if it is, in fact, the case that Pakistan hadn't shared this with America, I would think that things might be tense.
What about America's involvement in Afghanistan now? For a long time, everyone seemed to assume that bin Laden was hiding in Afghanistan. Turns out he was not. What does this mean for U.S. involvement there?
Right. Well, I think that the issue of the Taliban still remains a problem, but there are forces within Afghanistan, including, I think, Karzai himself, that would like America to leave and are saying now, well, you got bin Laden. He was your target. Now let us get up to the governing of our daily affairs without you. So we'll see what happens there.
Where does the global war on terrorism go from here? Bin Laden was the target, the most wanted man in the world, a lot of people called him. Now that he's gone, what's the objective of America's war on terrorism?
Well, I think that there are still some unanswered questions, such as the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo, and that there are still many grievances that people have against the United States. You know, when there's attacks on civilians in Afghanistan, or, you know, Iraq hasn't really fully established itself as a stable country yet. So I think that in any places where there's instability and people can blame America for it, or there are cases, isolated cases though they may be, where Americans actually commit violence against people without justification, just so, you know, such as the accidental civilian attacks in Afghanistan, I think there are still going to be reasons that people are going to be against the United States. And so I don't think the war on terror is over yet. I think it's still going to go on. It just won't go on in the same form that we're used to seeing.
Rachel Newcomb is an associate professor of anthropology at Rollins College in Orlando. She's an expert in Middle Eastern affairs. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks again for having me.
What do you think about Osama bin Laden's death? Email us at WMFE.org or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE. I'm Judith Smelser in for Mark Simpson. Coming up, jury selection begins next week in the Casey Anthony murder trial. Could the trial be the most expensive in state history? Plus, the four-woman Polk County bluegrass band, Ramblin' Rose, joins Mark Simpson in the WMFE studio for a performance. Stay with us here on Intersection. We go briefly now to a Central Florida story that's getting attention here and across the country, the Casey Anthony trial. Jury selection begins next week. Because of all the local press coverage, the jurors will be brought into Orlando from another city in Florida. We won't know where until Monday morning, but the court says it's going to cost about $360,000 to sequester them. To get some perspective on the costs of this trial, I spoke with Charles Rose, the director of the Center for Excellence in Advocacy at Stetson University's College of Law. He thinks the Anthony trial could be one of the most expensive in Florida's history. We'll hear more from him next week, but let's listen to a little of what he had to say about the costs of sequestering a jury.
Well, if you think about it for a moment, when you bring in a jury, you have to pay for hotel rooms, you have to pay for food, you have to pay for transportation, you have to pay for security. It's just like having a traveling professional athletic team or any other group that you take from one place to another that you're now responsible for. And they're going to be responsible for them pretty much 24/7 until the trial is over with.
Why do you think the court would have done that, would have made that decision instead of moving the venue altogether? I mean, what are the advantages? Are there cost advantages? Are there any advantages in your view?
Well, it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't scenario. If you don't bring the jury to you, then you have to bring yourself, the witnesses, the defendant, the defendant's witnesses. You have to bring everybody to the other location. And you got to remember, she's an indigent defendant now. So the state would wind up paying for all of those witnesses that are probably local to Orange County to go somewhere else. And you begin to balance it, and you begin to look at issues of control and the ability to produce witnesses who have been subpoenaed. And there's an argument that's relatively strong that it just makes more sense to keep it in Orange County for those reasons.
So from a cost perspective, do you think it would equal out either way?
I would say it's probably 6-1 or half a dozen of the other. It's going to be about the same when it's all said and done.
That was Charles Rose, director of the Center for Excellence in Advocacy at Stetson University's College of Law. He joined us from member station WUSF in Tampa. We'll hear more from him next week. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE. I'm Judith Smelser in for Mark Simpson. Coming up, Polk County's all-female bluegrass band Ramblin' Rose sat down with Mark recently in the WMFE studios. We'll hear some tunes.
The 12th annual Magnolia Park Bluegrass Festival is this Saturday in Apopka. Among the bands performing is Ramblin' Rose. Ramblin' Rose is a four-woman band. They're from a one-square-mile town of 15 houses called Chuneville outside of Lakeland. The group is made up of three generations of family members. 80-year-old Loretta Woodson is the family's matriarch. She is on guitar.
Hi.
We've got Renee Riddle on the fiddle.
Hi, everybody. How you doing?
Kathy Devane plays the banjo.
Howdy, y'all.
And Kristen Jenkins on the bass.
What's up?
And together they are Ramblin' Rose. Ladies, thank you so much for coming in here. Describe for me this town called Chuneville that you come from. It's way out there in Polk County. What's it like? What's the history there?
Well, the history of Chuneville starts back in the late 1800s when our father's people settled the land. And Mom and Dad had five kids, and we all ended up with a piece of the property. And by our maiden name being Chuning, the local townspeople started calling the area Chuningville, and that's how it came about.
Now, Renee, when you started playing bluegrass, how old were you?
I was 9 years old, but we're not going to count back that far.
So talk to me, how did you get into playing bluegrass? How did you get introduced to it?
Well, Mom and Dad would host pick-ins in our home, And that's where all the locals would come by and play some music and have potluck suppers. So we grew up in a house full of music. And I guess I was about 6 years old, went to a bluegrass festival. I saw a young group called the Bluegrass Little Bits, fell in love with their little fiddle player who was six at the time as well, and said, that's what I want to do is play the fiddle.
Well, Loretta, you're the matriarch of this group. How did you get started playing bluegrass?
Well, my girl started out playing with James Dockery, and he kind of got more interested in other things, and I told him, well, we'd make our own band, so we just stepped in and formed our own band.
Wow, and so where did you learn?
Well, I just played in the living room with different people that would come out. I've never been nothing but a rhythm player, and that's what I still do. So we used to have a lot of friends that come over, and they played different instruments. And my husband, he liked music, too. He used to play the fiddle some and guitar some.
So how did you decide that you were going to introduce your family, your daughters, into this music, this bluegrass?
Well, they actually took an interest in music before we ever put our bluegrass band together. And then when we decided that we was going to play together, we all sat down and tried to figure out a name for our band. And I come up with Ramblin' Rose, because we were all girls and we rambled. So.
Now, Kathy, you play the banjo. Talk to me a little bit about how you got interested in playing that particular instrument.
Oh, hands down, Ralph Stanley. He is my hero. If you'll see, I have his signature on my banjo. And that's who we grew up listening to. You know, we lived way out in the woods, and there wasn't a whole lot to do on Saturday night but listen to music or watch Mom and Daddy play. And, you know, Ralph Stanley is who we modeled our harmony after when we first started.
Uh-huh.
So he is my ultimate hero.
Kristen Jenkins, you are on bass, and how did you get interested in playing bluegrass? It sounds like you had some role models maybe along the way.
Yeah, sure did. You know, I started out playing with these guys, and it was all thanks to Mom and them that I started playing to begin with. If it wasn't for them, I wouldn't have learned.
So talk to me about the dynamic of playing in a family band. What's it like having to be the youngest member?
Oh, well, you know, it's kind of hard sometimes because I'm into different kinds of music than they are, but I love it all the same, and these guys are awesome to play with.
Is bluegrass your favorite type of music to play?
Absolutely.
How come?
You know, I guess I grew up listening to it. I grew up around it. You know, I kicked the back of her banjo for about 9 months there, so, you know, it just kind of stuck with me.
And so how long have you guys been playing then as a group all told?
The group was formed back in 1981. We were five members originally. We have an older sister who was our bass player and tenor singer, and a good friend of ours was a mandolin player. As they kind of got into other things in life and wasn't able to tour with the band, we looked at Kristen and said, it's time for you to learn an instrument. So
so there was some pressure to get in there.
Just a little bit.
Oh, yeah, just a little.
She was itching to go.
Well, great. Well, could you play us a tune?
Sure. How about Mama's favorite? One called Sally Gooden.
Thank you.
Tell me about that tune. Why do you play that one?
Well, that happens to be Mom's favorite tune and probably one of the first fiddle tunes that I learned as a child. So if we get in trouble if we don't play that one for Mama.
Now, talk to me a little bit about playing bluegrass out on the circuit in Florida. Is there a big circuit for bluegrass in the Sunshine State?
Actually, there is. You have to look for it, but we grew up going to bluegrass festivals. And as far as the Ramblin' Rose Band, we have about 4 or 5 different functions every year that are kind of a nice size event. Magnolia is one of them. We also perform in Fort Christmas every year for a festival. We also play, this will be, what, our 18th year at the City of Bartow's 4th of July celebration. And it's a struggle to find it, but if you get out and look, it's there.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. We're talking with Ramblin' Rose. They're an all-girl bluegrass band from Chewingville outside of Lakeland. They're performing this Saturday at the 12th Annual Magnolia Park Bluegrass Festival in Apopka. Loretta, you've been with this band for quite a while now. Talk to me about that dynamic of playing with your daughters and your granddaughter now. You know, what have been some of the good times?
Well, for me, it's all been good times. I mean, I just enjoy being in my family. And I've lost 2 husbands, and I'm by myself. And I said, my children is my life, really.
What do you think you've taught your family about life and music? What lessons have you been able to impart through this experience of playing in a family band?
Well, I hope it's to love one another, really, and enjoy being with one another.
Now, you guys play on the road quite a bit, right?
Yes, we have.
Well, tell us a story. What's a great story from adventures out on the road with the girls?
Well, I better not tell some of the stories out on the road with the girls.
Who wants to tell it?
Gosh.
I'll let Renee talk.
Well, Kathy will kind of have to help me on this. We did a show in Canada back in 1984, and it was when we had our older sister Linda with us, but there were about, what, 8 of us?
I think there were 9.
9 of us traveling.
In one van.
Traveling to Canada in one van. And
we would have to start the order. Before we knew there was a McDonald's coming up, you'd start an hour before, okay, what does, and the, whoever was driving, you had to feel sorry for them because they were like, okay, somebody get some paper, somebody write this down, you know, because somebody's not going to get what they want. And it was just an ordeal trying to get 9 people what they wanted, you know, food and everything. And so, you know, whenever we finally got it all together and we got to the drive-thru,
they would always forget to put something in the bag. Somebody's cheeseburger or French fries. And our older sister Linda was driving, and she literally backed up through the drive-thru to get our food. It was an ordeal, but that's one that we'll remember.
That was also the same time when we were going over into Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to know about your citizenship. And she looked at Mom, and she says, Mom, what am I? And she says, you're a United States citizen. She said, oh. So you could tell we had a good time when we traveled.
Green. It was fun.
Now, you folks have also worked up an original tune, I understand, for us.
Yes, that would be a song I wrote. It's a song about where we grew up called Chewingville City Limits. And we're debuting this song tonight. This is the first time out for us, so I'm kind of excited about that.
Did you write this, Kathy?
Yes, I did. We tease all the time, me and Renee, you know, when it comes to putting paper, you know, words on paper, we're good with you know, tunes, but it's hard to write. But this is just kind of tells you about where we grew up at, you know, and my grandpa, you know, that was his home, and then it was come down to Dad, and now it's down to us. History is just so important in our family. It's where we come from. So this kind of just tells you a little bit about Chewingville City Limits. Chewingville city limits, how I wished I was in it, back in my little country home. It's where I want to be, back with my family. I'm going back to Chewingville. Was raised back in the good old days. Family and friends treat you right, and all the stars don't matter. I'm going back to Chewingville. I wished I was in it. Back in my little country home is where I want to be. Back with my family, I'm going back to Junonville. It's where my roots belong. Back in my little country home, Mom and Dad are waiting for me. That's where I want to be. I'm going back to Junonville. Family and friends treat you right, and all the stars come out at night. I'm going back to Junonville. I'm going back to Junonville. I'm going back to Junonville.
We've been talking with Ramblin' Rose. They're a bluegrass band from Junonville outside of Lakeland. They're made up of Loretta Woodson on guitar. She's the grandmother. Renee Riddle on fiddle. She's Loretta's daughter. Loretta's other daughter, Kathy Devane, plays banjo. And granddaughter, Kristen Jenkins, on the bass. They're performing this Saturday at the 12th Annual Magnolia Park Bluegrass Festival in Apopka. Ladies, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you. This is a lot of fun. And I still miss someone.
That was 90.7's Mark Simpson talking to the bluegrass band Ramblin' Rose. You can hear more songs from their session in the WMFE studio on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. While you're there, you can also sign up for our weekly podcast and find a link to the Florida Talks blog, where you'll see what people are talking about across the state. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Judith Smelser. Mark Simpson will be back next week. Thanks for listening.